Just open Bibles, Genesis 2, page 1 of the Bible, and you'll see there that the, well, I think the chapter division at the end of Genesis 1 is a mistake. And the chapter division should have come, I think, at the end of chapter 2, verse 3, because you've got the first 6 days that are part of chapter 1, and then the seventh day, which has been bumped over into chapter 2. And this new subject, new narrative, begins at chapter 2, verse 4. But I think it makes much better sense to say you should have the first chapter and the first chapter of logic, including the whole 7 days. There's 7 days of creation. Only six of them God works, and on the seventh God rests. And you see there on the outline I've put a box there, and it sort of unpacks the structure of the first chapter of Genesis. And so on the first day, the way the week breaks up, on the first day there's light and dark created. That matches across to on the fourth day, sun, moon, stars and light, the things that cause the light are created. On the second day, the sky created, and that moves across to the fifth day, where birds go up into the sky. And on the third day, there's land created, and that matches up with the sixth day, where animals and humanity go out onto the land. But if there's that pattern matching first and fourth, second and fifth, third and sixth, the seventh day stands alone. Just see in the day, the seventh day, the first three verses of chapter 2, how the number 7 gets emphasis. Heavens and the earth are finished, all the host of them. On the seventh day, God finished his work that he'd done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he'd done in creation. Now, 7 is the number of completeness, the number of wholeness in the Bible. It shouldn't be a surprise if whole is 7 as a symbolic number, that 7 is the day that creation finishes on. Now, what is said about this seventh day? Well, God finished creating the heavens and the earth on the seventh day. God rested on the seventh day, and God blessed the seventh day. It's marvellous, isn't it? God finished making the world. The biggest construction job ever, on time, on budget. But why bother mentioning that he finished? By the seventh day, God had finished the work he'd been doing. I mean, the author spent a whole chapter telling us what God's been doing. It does seem a little superfluous, doesn't it, at first glance, to say he finished the work. No, it's not superfluous. He's stressing. There's nothing left undone. There's nothing left to be done. By stressing that the job is finished, he's saying it's complete. There's no potholes in God's finished world. There's no errors. There's no. It's how I can take you. We've renovated this building the last 12 months. Fraggle and I, we could take you around the building and show you the flaws. You may not spot them, but I can tell you about the little crack down in the floor there where there was a little demarcation dispute between the PA guys and the painting guys, and the PA guys thought it should have been the painting guys who finished that little bit of work, and the painting guys thought it should have been the PA guys who repaired that little bit of work, and so there's a little hole in the floor down there. It's not like that in God's good world. There was nothing undone left. When the guys finished, there was a little chip on the front door. Door through there, that there was the keyhole wasn't properly locked back in. All sorts of things were left unfinished that you didn't notice. But Frag and I got annoyed about them. We thought, oh, we were naive. We thought, oh, well, we should have not given them the money until they finished that little bit. And it's not like that when God made the world. On the seventh day, he finished it. And after that, he rested from all his work. Okay, well, all right, I can see the point, Dominic. It's important that God finished making the world, and it's good for me to know there's not a pothole here and a speaker wire problem there and nothing left undone like that in God's good creation. But do I need to know that God's gone on holidays? That God's having a rest? Yes, because it tells me something about God. It tells me there's more to God than making worlds. It's more to God than going to work. There's more to his personality than world-making. See, Rupert Murdoch spends his whole life flying from board meeting here to board meeting there to board meeting here to board meeting there to board meeting there to board meeting there. I don't know if he's got any interests apart from board meetings. At least I know Kerry Packer is interested in gambling and polo playing. There's more to Kerry Packer's life than Channel 9. But as far as I can tell, I've read William Shawcross's biography of Murdoch, and there's nothing left in his life apart from board meetings. That God rests on the seventh day tells me there's more to God than world-making, and that Genesis lists the rest day as included in the creation package implies that rest is intrinsic to the whole thing, not some optional extra. In fact, rest is the goal of the whole thing. Now, God is not negative about this rest day. See, sometimes we think, well, I need to rest in order to recover, in order to be able to keep going the next day. So 2:3, God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, special, separate, because on it he rested from the work of creating he'd done. In Mesopotamia, in the ancient world, in the thinking of the ancient world, the seventh day was a negative, a cursed day, a day of evil. But in biblical thinking, seven is positive. It's culmination. Rest day is holy. Rest day is special. Sometimes I've had the wrong idea here. Sometimes I've thought, well, I've got to rest pragmatically because otherwise I'll be exhausted and won't be able to do something tomorrow. So, yes, I have to rest, but I don't really want to rest. I'd rather keep going. That's not God's attitude. And final point from Genesis 2, the seventh day is still going. See, it's not the last in the cycle. It's the goal of the series. God works in order to rest. See, all the other days, God said, let there be. There was. It was good. Morning, evening, first day. Now, on Wednesday night when I do that, I want you to look better than stunned mullets. For those cutaway shots for the camera, we wanted you to see some. Maybe, you could help us if we can get this rhythm happening here. Because I do it and they just look like stunned mullets, do you know? but we saw that kind of. I won't make you. On Wednesday, I want you to do it for me. No, I don't want to. We'll do it. Come on, Nate. Come and help me. Come and help me. Come and help me. Yeah, come on. Oh, no. Frank says no. Better not. But there's that pattern. God said, let there be. There was. It was good. Morning, evening, first day. You get to the end of Genesis 2, to chapter 2, and it starts with the seventh day. But there's none morning, evening, seventh day at the end of it. And I take it that the seventh day is still going. God rests on the seventh day. God's still resting on the seventh day. You say, okay, if God's still resting and this is the seventh day we're still in, well, who's keeping the lights on? Who's making the sun rise? I think God is resting from his work of creating. See, on my day off, tomorrow, having a day off, I will be resting from the work of Christians in the media. But I'll still do my things as a father. I'll still work at teaching Solomon the alphabet, all those kind of things that I can do. But I'll be resting from my work of Christians in the media. And what do we learn about God? We learn from all of this that God is a worker. For God's image, we should be workers too. We learn about the character of God. There's nothing negative about work. It's a good, right and proper thing to work. In other worldviews written at the same time of Genesis, the Mesopotamian thought that the gods did not work. Humanity works so the gods could rest. Work's bad, rest is good. The gods didn't work, they rested. That's not the biblical idea. But you see that idea in some societies around our world. There's the picture of the person who's made it is the person who does not have to work. The child who grows up with a silver spoon in their mouth. Remember the TV commentators after the death of Diana? They said, wasn't that wonderful that Diana taught William and Harry to go to shops and queue up in supermarkets? Do you remember that? Because if they'd just been children of the royal family, they wouldn't have actually gone to a supermarket queue ever. There's something right about a spoilt brat having to queue up in Coles. It's good for them to work. It's positive. In Genesis 1, work is seen as a good, right and proper thing, that the God of the universe works, that the God of the universe gets his hand dirty. We also learn that God is a rester, that there's more to God than going to work, that work is not what God lives for. What about we as God's image bearers? Well, we as image bearers of God, as creatures of the Creator, we should have the same pattern of life, I take it, as our Creator. We shouldn't work 7 days a week. We should have rest as part of our week, and we should not live to work, but we should work looking forward to resting. Atheist societies have mucked around with the pattern of six on, one off. The Russians at one stage tried different combinations. They found a whole series of trials that they got the best performance of out of people by working six and resting one. They tried a rest day every 6 days, and productivity went down. No one worked any harder. They just had more rest days. They tried rest day every 8 days. Productivity went down. People got sick more from exhaustion. And I think it is true, pragmatically, that if we don't rest, productivity goes down, we become lethargic, we become exhausted. But I'm not urging it from the point of pragmatics. I'm urging it from the point of we are made in the image of God. And that's how our Creator functions. And that's how we as his image bearers should function. Okay, enough on Genesis 2. Let's chase this theme through the rest of the Bible. Roller skates on. If you're new with us tonight, we don't usually work you this hard, but we are going to work hard tonight. Exodus chapter 16. Flick forward to Exodus chapter 16, verse 22. Book after Genesis. The Israelites are on their way out of captivity from Egypt. They've been in captivity from Egypt. They haven't yet been given the Ten Commandments. 16:22. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much. They're walking through the desert, two omers for each person. And the leaders of the community came and reported this to Moses. He said to them, "This is what the Lord commanded. Tomorrow is to be a day of rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. So bake what you want to bake and boil what you want to boil. Save whatever's left and keep it till morning." So they saved it till morning, as Moses commanded, and it did not stink or get maggots in it. "Eat it today," Moses said, "because today is a Sabbath to the Lord. You won't find any of it on the ground today. 6 days you're to gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will not be any." Here's God's people being provided for in the desert. He looks after them. They're dependent on them, on him. He gives them food, and he gives them rest one day in seven. Now, Ten Commandments, this pattern's formalized. Flick forward a couple of pages to Exodus 20. Remember the Sabbath day, Exodus 20, verse 8. "By keeping it holy, 6 days you shall labor and do your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your manservant, nor maidservant, nor your animals, nor the alien within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that's in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath and made it holy." The reason given for the rest day here is creation. You've got to work six because God works six in creation. You rest one because God rested one. The rest day is to be separate, to be different to all the other days. That you have a rest day reminds you there's more to life than work. Now, in Exodus 31, the stakes are raised. The death penalty is introduced for breaching the Sabbath. 31:12. The Lord said to Moses, Exodus 31:12, "Say to the Israelites, you must observe my Sabbaths. This will be a sign between me and you for the generations to come, so that you will know that I am the Lord who makes you holy. Observe the Sabbath because it's holy to you. Anyone who desecrates it must be put to death. Whoever does any work on that day must be cut off from his people. For 6 days work is to be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day must be put to death. The Israelites are to observe the Sabbath, celebrating it for the generations to come as a lasting covenant. It'll be a sign between me and the Israelites forever. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day he abstained from work and rested." And again, the reason given is rest because of God's goodness in creation. That you have a rest day reminds you you're heading to rest with God ultimately. But see how important it is to God that the Israelites rest. And it's only recently that I've realized this. And doing the work that I do in Christian ministry, I've kept thinking, well, at any time I can do an extra 10 minutes for God, that's worth it. Any time I can just sneak an extra 10 minutes to stuff envelopes for a newsletter or just to do this, to do that, to get any little extra bit done to advance the kingdom of heaven, I think that's good. Every time I can not watch the video, not watch the telly, but do something that's productive for the kingdom. And so as I've thought about this passage in the lead up to teaching you guys on it tonight, I've realized that for years I have compromised rest days. But in this passage, God says, more than I want you to be productive, I want you to trust me. I want you to rest. On the rest day, don't go get food. Don't be productive. Trust me. And the ones who worked, the ones who didn't trust, were stoned to death. That's a bit of a shock, isn't it? Because you can sort of come at the idea that in the Old Testament somebody commits adultery, so they're stoned to death. But it does seem a bit rugged that somebody goes out looking for bread on Saturday and so gets stoned to death. Doesn't it seem a bit rugged? Or am I the only one that it seems rugged to? But what I've realised is adultery is a breach of trust with my wife, whereas collecting bread on the Sabbath for the Israelite was a breach of trust with their God. See why it's as serious? What's it mean for me? Hold your horses. Keep coming forward to Deuteronomy 5. Deuteronomy 5, sentence 12. Now, this is Ten Commandments again. We're 40 years on from where the Ten Commandments were given the first time, though. The Israelites have finished their 30, 40 years in the desert, and they're about to go into the Promised Land. Moses is about to take them in, holds a final assembly for them, before he gives them the Promised Land. And Moses repeats the Ten Commandments that they were given. And there's one difference in the commandments that are given here, Deuteronomy 5, 12, to the Ten Commandments that were given in Exodus. Observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy, as the Lord your God has commanded you. 6 days you shall labour and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your manservant, nor your maidservant, nor your ox, your donkey, or any of your animals, nor the alien within your gates, so that your manservant and maidservant may rest as you do. Remember, you were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath day. The reason there to be observers of the Sabbath is not because God created six and rested one, but because you used to be a slave in Egypt. The motive cited here isn't creation, but that it's God that rescued you, that God is now giving you the promised land. In Exodus 20, it was that God is a resting God who gives you, who has the purpose of rest, who wants you to have the purpose of rest. Creation. In Deuteronomy, it's that God is about to give you rest. He's about to give you the promised land where you can rest. It's not a contradictory reason, it's the same reason come at from a different angle. You get the same sort of idea in Leviticus 25. Flick backwards to Leviticus 25. And essentially what God is saying here in Leviticus is that when you enter my rest, when you enter the promised land, make sure you don't work the land to death. Make sure you give the land proper rests. And so it introduces the whole idea of the Sabbath year. We've had the Sabbath day, now the Sabbath year. Leviticus 25:1. The Lord said to Moses on Mount Sinai, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, when you enter the land I'm going to give you, the land itself must observe a Sabbath to the Lord. For 6 years sow your fields, for 6 years prune your vineyards, gather their crops. But in the seventh year the land is to have a Sabbath of rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. Do not sow your fields or prune your vineyards. Do not reap what grows of itself or harvest the grapes of your untended vines. The land is to have a year of rest." Come down to verse 8. Count off seven Sabbaths of years, seven times 7 years, so that the seven Sabbaths of years amount to a period of 49 years. Then have the trumpet sounded everywhere on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. Sound the trumpet through the land. Consecrate the 50th year. Proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It'll be a jubilee for you. Each one of you is to return to his family property, each to his own clan. The 50th year will be a jubilee. Do not sow, do not reap what grows of itself or harvest the untended vines. It's a jubilee. It's to be holy to you. Eat only what's taken directly from the fields. In the year of Jubilee, it's the Monopoly board. We go right back to the start. Everyone is to return to his... That was my little ad-lib there. In the year of Jubilee, everyone is to return to his own property. If you sell land to one of your countrymen or buy for him, do not take advantage of the other. You're to buy from your countryman on the basis of the number of years since the Jubilee, and he's to sell to you on the basis of the years left for harvesting crops before the Jubilee. When the years are many, you increase the price. When the years are few, you decrease the price. What he's really selling you is the number of crops. So what it is there's 7 years and you have a year of fallow, a year of a break. You get to 50 years, 7 times 7, and then we clear all the pieces on the Monopoly board. Everyone gives their hotels back, everyone gives their houses back, and we all start again with a blank slate. Unfortunately, what happened was the Israelites were so sinful, they never got through 50 years of settled life in the land. The Jubilee year, the 50th year, it never came. There's no record of the Jubilee ever being kept. The year of God's favour, when we clear the Monopoly board, it never came. Now, the Israelites are living in the land, living in God's rest. Joshua had brought them into the promised land. There, we've gone through the period of judges. King David takes the throne. We flick forward to Psalm 95. Around about the middle of the Bible, Psalm 95. King David is on the throne of Israel. David is speaking to people who right now live in the promised land, who right now are living in the rest of God. Psalm 95, sentence 6. Come, let us bow down in worship. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God. We are the people of his pasture, the flock under his care. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as you did at Meribah, as you did that day at Massah in the desert, where your fathers tested and tried me, though they'd seen what I did. For 40 years I was angry with that generation. I said, there are people whose hearts go astray. They have not known my ways. So I declared on oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest. Now, Psalm 95 is a warning to people to make sure they don't miss out on entering the rest of God. What strikes you as funny there? Something which should be ringing an alarm bell. He's saying, don't miss out on entering the rest of God. It's vital that you don't miss out on entering the rest of God. Remember those people before. They had hard hearts, and so they missed out on entering my rest. Don't be like them. We don't want you to miss out on entering the rest of God. What's the problem? Sorry? They're already living in the rest of God. They're already living in the promised land. Well, either David doesn't know what he's talking about, or the rest of God is a bigger and different concept. The ultimate rest of God is a bigger and different concept to just living in the promised land. Again, hold that thought. The people don't listen to that warning of King David. They go on in sin. The fortunes of Israel get worse and worse. There's pronouncements of judgment from the prophets. But the prophets, again, will they start to speak positively of a day when the year of God's favour would come, when the Jubilee year would come, when the Monopoly board would get cleared, and when justice would be done, when a new deal would be done for the people. Isaiah 61. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is upon me, says the prophet Isaiah, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. What would be good news to the poor? Everyone gives their hotels back. Everyone gives their houses back. We all start again at go in equal standing with $200. Good news to the poor. He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour, to proclaim the rest of God. And then Jesus walks onto centre stage of the Gospels and begins his public ministry in Luke chapter 4. He walks onto the centre stage. Sits in the synagogue. He went to Nazareth, 4:16 of Luke's Gospel, where he'd been brought up. On the Sabbath day, he went into the synagogue, as was his custom. He stood up to read. The scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. Unrolling it, he found the place where it's written, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me. He's anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind, release for the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour. And then 21, he began by saying, today, this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. And what Jesus is saying is it's the rest year. The Jubilee's arrived. The time of God's favour's come. It's all being put right. Jesus is the great bringer of rest. Just as Moses led the Israelites, they were in slavery to Egypt, and he led them to rest in God's promised land. So as Jesus comes, he comes to a people in slavery to sin and leads them to rest in heaven. How does it work today? Well, two things. First application from Hebrews chapter 3. Hebrews chapter 3. And Hebrews chapter 3 picks up Psalm 95 and applies it to the Christian life today. Hebrews chapter 3, as the Holy Spirit says. This is what the Holy Spirit is saying to you today, if you hear his voice. Do not harden your hearts as you did in the rebellion during the time of testing in the desert, where your fathers tested and tried me, where for 40 years they saw what I did. That's why I was angry with that generation, and I said their hearts are always going astray, and they have not known my ways. So I declared on oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest. So therefore, application to us today. Verse 12, see to it, brothers and sisters, that none of you has a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God. But encourage one another daily, as long as it's called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. We have come to share in Christ if we hold firmly till the end the confidence we had at first. And as has just been said, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as you did in the rebellion. Who were they who heard and rebelled? Were they not with those Moses led out of Egypt? Who was with those he was angry with for 40 years? Was it not those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the desert? To whom did God swear they'd never enter his rest, if not to those who disobeyed? We see they were not able to enter because of their unbelief. Therefore, the promise of entering God's rest still stands. The promise of entering God's rest still stands. The seventh day is still going. It's still possible to join God who's resting. We can look forward to being at rest with him. Make sure you don't miss out on making it to holidays with God. Let us be careful that none of you be found to have fallen short. For we also had the gospel preached to us just as they did. But the message they heard was of no value because those who heard it did not combine it with faith. Now we who have believed enter that rest. We enter the rest with every bit of confidence, the same strength of confidence that they, he said to them, they shall never enter his rest because he declared on oath on their anger. For all the strength that God said no to them, he says yes to us. You know that expression, no rest for the wicked? You know where that comes from? Hebrews chapter 3. It's talking about they shall never enter my rest. The wicked won't. The unbelieving won't. The disobedient won't. But it's not talking about resting on the weekend. It's talking about resting with God in heaven. And if you lost my train of thought, if you're wicked, if you're unbelieving, you will have no rest. But those who do believe, those who trust, will enter God's rest, yet his work has been finished. 4:3 of Hebrews, his work has been finished since the creation of the world, for somewhere he has spoken. Every theological student, college student, loves that verse. For somewhere God said something. You feel like, if you ever have to write an essay on theology and you're not sure where the Bible verse is, just write in brackets Hebrews chapter 4, verse 4. For somewhere he said something. And they can't mark you down, because otherwise they have to mark down the apostolic writer. And it's out of the logic of this evening's sermon, but it's a useful hint. For somewhere he has spoken about the seventh day in these words, on the seventh day God rested from all his work. And again in the passage above he says, they shall never enter my rest. It still remains that some will enter the rest. God's rest is continuing today. Down to Hebrews 4:8, if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken later about another day. The rest that Joshua gave in the promised land, it wasn't the ridgy-didgy rest. The real rest is still to come. For anyone who enters God's rest also rests from his own work, just as God did from his. Let us therefore make every effort to enter that rest, so that no one will fall by following their example of disobedience. What are we to do? We're to hear the message, longing for the rest with God, and combine it with faith, combine it with trust. That's point one of application to us. Point two is from Colossians 2. Flick back a couple of pages to Colossians 2, sentence 15. And if you are new with us, it's not usually this complex. It's a big one tonight. Not usually this complex. Colossians 2, sentence 15. Having disarmed the powers and authorities, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross. Therefore, do not let anyone judge you by what you eat or drink, or with regard to a religious festival, a new moon celebration, or a Sabbath day. Following the cross of Christ, don't let someone judge you about what you do over the Sabbath. Because every Christian is living in the Sabbath rest, there's no place for judging each other on this matter. And so I want to preserve Christian freedom on this issue. I want us to be able to disagree on this issue, to come back to the issue Jen raised before about, well, if Eric Liddell couldn't run on the Sabbath, we have real problems in our 24/7 world of shift work. I want to say Eric Liddell could make the stand out of his Christian conscience to not run on the Sabbath, and yet I might be free to run on the Sabbath. I want to respect his Christian conscience and ask him to respect my Christian conscience that it allows me to go running on that day. Do not judge one another by what you do with regard to religious festival, new moon celebration, or Sabbath day. Some people will shop for carpet on Sundays and some won't. And we must allow each other to have Christian freedom on that matter. These things, 17:17, are a shadow of the things that were to come. The reality is found in Christ. What day you have off is an irrelevance. What matters is, do you trust Jesus? And so I want to say my Seventh-day Adventist friends are lovely, but I think they are too caught up on this issue. And do you know that every Bible passage we've looked at on the Sabbath, and we've really done a helter-skelter through all of them tonight, going to church on the Sabbath doesn't even blink, doesn't even raise an issue. What you do here on the rest day is rest. Where and when you go to church, whether it's Wednesday, Friday, Saturday or Sunday, or Monday or Tuesday, or Thursday, is a completely different issue. And I think it is a great sin for someone to say, our church is better because we church on Saturday, or others to say, our church is better because we church on Sunday. Because those people who do that are certainly being disobedient to Colossians 2:16. They're judging others for what they do over the Sabbath. So, what's life about? I've had to have a major rethink on these issues over the last few months. And I think to live for work is a flawed philosophy. For the aim of life is to join God at rest. The Presbyterian Church is right. What is the purpose of humanity? To worship God and enjoy Him forever. That's our goal as people, to look forward to enjoying God, to resting with God forever. Now, this is true. The idea that living for work is a flawed philosophy, whatever your work is. It's true whether you work in the newsroom. It's true whether you work in Christian ministry. We're talking in the Fairfax Bible Study Group, and one of the guys made the point during the week that he'd come to see over the last few years that producing brilliant-looking front pages for Fairfax ultimately has no eternal value. Don't live for Fairfax. They will chew you up and spit you out. But then you think, well, what he's done in gospel ministry, that has eternal value. I can make a stronger case to be a workaholic in gospel ministry than a workaholic in media work. Now, ultimately, the case fails there too. For the character of our God is not to be a seven-day-a-week worker. The character of the God that we worship is to work six and rest one. I said no to several job offers in the Federal Parliamentary Press Gallery because I knew that at the time I was tempted to workaholism, to work too hard, to worship work. And I, who had trouble taking time off already, thought that in the heady competitive environment of the Canberra Press Gallery, I would not be able to keep a personal perspective, and that in the end I would end up worshipping work and living for work and not living for the day of enjoying God forever. I'm not saying, therefore, no Christian should work in the Canberra Press Gallery. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, for me, with my particular set of weaknesses, I couldn't do it. So let me ask you in conclusion, before we open for questions, what are you living for? Are you living to work, for work, or are you living for resting with God? If your ultimate goal in life is to be a great journalist, or a great accountant, or a great whatever it is, then you are not in tune with God's purposes. But if your goal in life is to work for a while you head to your promised rest, then you are in tune with God's purposes. But work is not the end point of life. Life is about resting with God. God's goal is eternal rest. That should be our goal. We are the people that God has chosen to go on holidays with. He's chosen to share his holidays with us. That's great, isn't it? We're not to be workaholics. I'm not to be a workaholic. There are graves all round the world full of indispensable men who are now dispensable.